Welcome to Discover Indie Film. I'm your host, Jeff Howard, and I'm honored. I've got two filmmakers on Zoom right now. Although you could tell me if you, of course you like the term filmmaker, although we're going to be talking about a TV pilot, I believe. But I've got Shelley Daniels and Cheryl Grave here.
Hi.
Hello.
So their film, I'm going to call it a film. They submitted The Resentful Angel to the Sherman Oaks Film Festival in 2020 when we were wrapped by COVID. So I actually got to speak to you 2 years ago on Zoom. And now here we are 2 years later on Zoom again. And if people have complaints about the audio quality, I like to say just blame the Zoom Corporation. They're compressing it in the recording. It's not our fault. Mm-hmm. Although, honestly, the audio quality has gotten better. So
that's great.
Exciting news. The Resentful Angel is in season 7 of the Discover Indie Film TV series.
Yeah.
There's nothing better than gruff, dark comedy, if you ask me. But
I love it. I love that. I love how you're describing it. Gruff, dark comedy. I would say gruff, troubled comedy. I'm trying to use the word dark in a positive way lately.
In fact, among my compliments will be, you know, what can I say? I'm going to say that, dear listener, I'm cutting to the chase. And I'm going to say that the lead character who Cheryl plays is a gruff crank, which is a character that who doesn't try to be sympathetic and really just goes at us. And that's a kind of character that I don't think has equal gender representation in general film. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So I just kind of I love your performance. I am affected by society and gender roles, and that women always feel like they've got to be pleasing, and your character doesn't feel the need to be pleasing.
Yeah. Can I curse on this podcast?
100%.
So I just want to say fucking A to what you just said. Fucking A. Yes.
Yeah, because we all grew up with binary gender roles. It's tough for me to have a conversation that doesn't acknowledge it, you know, especially with something like The Resentful Angel. But anyway, wait, so it's in the Discovery Indie Film TV series, season 7, which launches January 15th. And I guess I should have said released on January 15th, because I think this one will come out about a week after, 1 or 2 weeks after. So our timing is good.
Oh, good.
And that's all I have to say. Oh, and where's the Discover Indie Film TV series? It's on Amazon Prime Video. So people should go to Prime Video on a big TV. Don't watch movies on your phone if you can avoid it. But go to a big TV with the Prime Video app and type in Discover Indie Film. It'll auto-complete at some point and enjoy season 7. I'll add that we're not included with Prime anymore. It's not free, but it's $7.99. for a 10-episode season. So that's $8 for 10 episodes with, I believe, 24 films included.
Such a good deal.
Independently made. So, you know, you're kicking $8 towards, yes, the beautiful Amazon Corporation takes like half of it. But then the other half goes to people who made films right from their hearts and souls and not because they sat around a table and said, so how can we take advantage of our IP and maximize the profits here? Because honestly, no one ever made a short film with profit in mind.
I'm not going to argue with that. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, God willing, your film was going to lead to something because it's a proof of concept kind of pilot idea.
Yeah.
And it really is setting something up by the end. But enough of that. I hope you both know that I like to get to know people really well on the podcast so that the listeners get to know. So the question is, who wants to go first talking about how you ended up in the arts? I'm going to assume, by the way, your names are both all over the film.
Cheryl's going first.
And there's a major, the lead actor goes first.
Yeah.
Shut the fuck up. How did you get into the arts and acting and writing and everything?
Great question. I'll go back in time. I'm from Pennsylvania originally and born in Allentown, PA. And my dad worked for Bethlehem Steel. And just a little bit of background, because I think parents have a I'll just say for me, had a lot to do with why I wanted to tell story and the culture of my family, which was my dad was kind of, he was a military guy who almost got into West Point, but then went to the Merch Marine Academy and hung around guys who were so ambitious and, you know, gonna, within this culture that we live in. And my dad said all he wanted to do was get old and sit on the porch and have a beer. So that's kind of my dad. Like, so there's a military with no ambition, I think that's an ambition. I'd like to sit on a porch and have a beer too. A cider, please. But he married my mom, who was probably a brilliant artist who never realized that herself because she lived within the formula of the 1950s. And she was like, anything goes. You can do anything you want. So I think I was more like my mom than my dad. But so it was a really interesting household. And there were there was a lot of tension there between the two. And I wanted to talk about it. I wanted to tell stories about it, but I wasn't conscious of this when I was young. And so in fourth grade, there was no program at my school. So I was like, I'm going to produce my own shows. So I did. And things went a little off the rail at times with our productions, but they were well intentioned and meaning to like bring everyone together and create community. And then I knew I wanted to do this once I hit middle school. I knew this was my calling. I wanted to be an actor. And little did I know, I was always a producer. I just sort of just did it. I just organized. And then went to undergrad at a small state college in Pennsylvania, Westchester University. Then went straight to grad school, which is where I started working with University of Iowa, which is where I started working with playwrights and realizing I loved playwrights and I loved writers and I loved working with new works. And it just was like, this is a soul's calling. This is where I'm called to move in my life. And then 2 years after I left college, I was like, where am I going to move to? And I moved to Chicago, coming here to just get my union cards and go to the East Coast, to New York City. And I fell in love with it here. And it took me a while to get my union cards, but I got them finally. And I love it here because I feel like Chicago, it was a place for me to develop as an artist, where I could live at a reasonable price and still wait tables, but still make my own art and still produce my own art. And I feel it's a very ensemble-based theater scene. I mean, things are changing, maybe, Shelley. I don't know. I've sort of stepped away from the theater a bit in town since we started creating our pilot. But without living in Chicago, I would not have met this beautiful, beautiful, talented human being, Shelley Daniels. And so, I train, I still take classes, and you know, you never arrive. I wish we did, but we don't. But maybe that's good. And that's it.
Well, let me ask a question that kind of almost applies to the whole thing. But so, as a young person, you were driven really to create and write, and then acting came along. Like, was it always sort of a balance between performance and creating your own, writing your own stuff?
That's a great question. I think I think yes, but I left that behind for a time. I really have been since my mid-20s on a trajectory of a traditional actor. Like, I have an agent, had great agents here in Chicago, and just recently decided, this past May, I decided to take a big break from my fabulous agents, and I'm deeply grateful that they said, keep the door open if you want to come back. But I wanted to take a break because now it's interesting. That's a great question, because I think you're intuiting that I feel like right now I want to start creating my own work. And I feel like there's stories that are not being told that need to be told. And I hope I'm finding some of those stories. And so within myself, within working with Shelley, of course, yes to both.
And both you and Shelley, I mean, this, obviously you met in Chicago. I do find it interesting. So you grew up in Pennsylvania and then, you know, college, kind of Midwestern. And then, yeah, the decision to stay in Chicago instead of, you know, going out to either coast. Mm-hmm. I got to admit, as a third generation Angeleno, mm-hmm. I kind of hold a place like Chicago in high esteem because I have a bias that, well, I grew up in the town that everyone moves to because they think they're going to be a movie star. And so I kind of dig the people who don't. I mean, no offense to the people who do.
Yeah.
But I don't think people stay. I don't think that the, like you said, it's ensemble based. And I mean, it has an amazing history of performance and stuff being made there. It's not like films and TV aren't made there. But like, if someone's finishing high school and thinks they're the next Tom Cruise, they come here.
You know, I feel like, well, that's interesting because, you know, to sort of go back to my mom and dad, they're both very formulaic of this is how you do things. And I think that my life has really been about how do I break out of the formula and find what really is calling me. And like when I lived in New York City briefly and, you know, people would say, this is the only place to be. And part of me was like, well, I don't fucking believe that. And I think Chicago, the thing that's really been terrific is I feel Chicago people, and there's a lot of TV going on here now that were real. I mean, our actors here are just, I mean, all over the place. I don't want to say there's any place that has the best actors, but I will put a little plug out that you live in Chicago when you don't know when the temperature is going to change and it can go from 50 to 20 in like a few hours, it builds character. I'll just say it builds character. So.
Well, and obviously we need Shelley to jump in, but I'll add that nobody can argue that particularly the comedy community, I mean the comedy traditions out of Chicago, Second City or not. Mm-hmm. I mean, anybody who's a fan of comedy is way more aware that Chicago and Canada produce people that beat the shit out of most. And in fact, most, and like one of my favorite podcasts is Mark Maron's. And he always talks about how people should find their voice in San Francisco or Boston. Mm-hmm. You should get your stage time away from LA and New York to learn how to be funny. Mm-hmm. And I just, you know, honestly, there's more people in California than Canada, and more funny Canadians. I just don't, it's just undeniable.
I'm actually Canadian.
Yes.
That's a perfect transition. Okay.
I mean, I wanted, you know, obviously I want Cheryl to, you know, I didn't want to jump on Cheryl,
Shelley,
whatever, but everything you're saying, Jeff, I mean.
Well, it's your turn anyway, so I'll pretend I had an inkling you're from Canada, and now we've brought up that somehow a fairly chilly country that, again, has fewer people in it than California produces great comedian after great comedian, and honestly, even drama, but I won't go on and on about Canada. Tell us about your story.
I'm Canadian, as I said. I was actually born in England, and then pretty quickly my parents were Canadian, moved back to Canada. So my younger years were in growing up in Canada, Toronto. I mean, I don't know. I'm sort of like now thinking about the whole comedy thing, but we'll get there because I was just sort of distracted by what you were saying about comedy and Canada just has a lot of meaning for me. But I was thinking about my early day, like when did my creative whatever, and I'm one of those people who's always been writing and acting, just like a lot of creative people, somewhat more consciously in one direction, less consciously in another. But I was thinking about some of my early, you know, just like Cheryl was talking about her early theater performing experiences. And I was thinking how Canadian mine was because 5 years old, you know, Canada, when I was younger, was still part of the Commonwealth of England. And so what we would do, or what I would get my friends to do, is to play queen, you know, because the queen was everywhere. Everything was the queen. And so one person would play the queen and the other people would play the subjects. And it was always, you know, you always wanted to play the queen, of course. And I theorized, we always wondered, how did the queen become queen? Like, you know, we're 5 years old. We don't know. So I came up with the theory that the queen became the queen because, and had her riches, because so many people gave her presents. And if you had enough birthday presents, you could become queen. Like, it makes sense, right? So we would enact scenes with giving presents or getting presents. And that was my early project early on, very Canadian. And then my family, when I was in third grade, moved to Los Angeles. So
saying third grade instead of grade three.
Say that again.
I said that explains why you called it third grade instead of grade three.
Oh, is that right? Is that
in Canada, you say grade three.
Oh, that's funny. Yeah.
I didn't mean to interrupt. I'm sorry.
No, that's okay. There's a lot. No, please. There's a lot of things that I no longer do, speech things that I was made fun of a little bit when I first moved from Toronto. But when I moved, and I don't know if you know this, but when we moved here, my mom enrolled me in a children's theater where children performed, called the Van Nuys Sherman Oaks Children's Repertory Storybook Playhouse. Did you? I don't even know if you ever knew of it. Anyways, it was this theater that had classes, drama classes for children. But then the children, like me, would also perform on the weekends, and we would do plays all Saturday, all Sunday for other kids. It was a real theater, and you know, they were semi-serious about the whole thing. And so I spent a lot of time doing that. And I wanted to act. I was like a little kid, just determined to act, actually. I was writing the whole time, but not consciously. Like, I wrote stories and plays and performed in them. And, you know, fifth grade, I was such an expert. I taught acting classes after school and wrote plays for kids. And after junior high school, my parents wanted me, I'd been in public school, and my parents wanted, you know, better education kind of thing. And they sent me to this sort of arty hippie private school, which you probably know, Oakwood, in North Hollywood.
I was about to ask you which middle school, just for me, because
right,
we're both Valley kids.
Exactly. I'm a Valley kid.
Oakwood is a block away from North Hollywood High, right?
Exactly. Yeah. On Magnolia.
You know, I don't know the last time you saw it, but they bought the property across the way of Magnolia, and there's a bridge going over the street. It's unbelievable.
I know. It's unbelievable. When I went there, of course, it was pretty bare bones. You know, it was much more hippie, you know, whatever, but it's been very built up. But it was a very arty Hollywood, you know, school, and really nice kids, amazingly creative in every direction, you know, painting, singers, poets, dancers, actors, like just, it was nirvana for me. It was just, it was heaven, you know, to be around that much creative people at that young age. You know, it was, you know, people talk about hating high school, and I had the opposite experience, because it was like camp for me. It was just creative camp is what it was. And I met so many amazing kids, and, you know, but I was still acting at that point, and then had to decide, you know, for college, I was trying to decide, whether to go to college or go to acting school. You know, and I was very serious about acting. I went to ACT, you know, with my friend. I lied to get in, and, you know, American Conservatory Theater. I mean, I was like very, very ambitious little actress. But I got to a point where I just, you know, I had been acting for so long by that point, which sounds ridiculous at age heading into college, but I had been. And I don't think this now, but at the time I felt like it wasn't quite enough of an expression for me for some reason. And maybe I just wasn't as good as I should have been. But then in college, you know, I was on literary magazines and wrote TV spoof, you know, made a TV show even in college called General University, which was a soap opera spoof. Anyways, going on and on. Don't mean to go on so much. But in college, I realized that that writing was really more what I wanted to do. And then after college, even though I had been writing short stories, I realized that my home was in the theater. And so I went back to writing plays. And so I was writing plays and never looked back. And then I was involved in Chicago theater, writing plays. Became a Chicago playwright, basically, and never looked back and loved it, you know, loved Chicago theater, loved my experience.
When was the move to Chicago?
So the move to Chicago was when I left college. To your point earlier, I thought, well, I can go to New York, I can go to Los Angeles. But honestly, having grown up in Los Angeles, I was overwhelmed by Los Angeles. I think that's the only way to say it. I was overwhelmed by the Hollywood aspect. I was overwhelmed by the lookism. I was overwhelmed by the caste system of Hollywood. And none of it felt like I felt overwhelmed by it. And I just didn't feel like I fit there. I loved New York, but I also felt a little like I couldn't quite access it in the same way. And when I got to Chicago after college, I had friends there. I had a boyfriend there. And I was like, this feels like it's more accepting. It's more open. I feel like I can grow here and not be judged in the same way. And these are like, I just felt freer, you know? And so that's why I chose Chicago to live.
Yeah. Especially since you had fallen in love with theater, because now this is briefly about me, but it's about the theater scene in Los Angeles. There is both a thriving theater scene, and yet you have to do so much work as an audience member, as an audience goer, to see it, because everything is drowned out by the big stuff. You know, you got musicals from Broadway at the Pantages and stuff at the Dorothy Chandler Center. And it's like, okay, there's this big shit going on. But if you want to see indie plays being performed by people writing them, they're around and you got to work your ass off to find it's whereas Chicago, my understanding is it's kind of a
it's everywhere. Yeah, that's so, so true. I mean, for some reason I did see a certain amount of theater growing up in Los Angeles, like the North Hollywood area where the smaller theaters were that were so exciting. And but yeah, you're right. And the other thing is, having had a few productions in Los Angeles, you're competing for actors who don't want to commit necessarily because of their other work and their jobs. And that's sort of a strange thing. Whereas in Chicago, I mean, Cheryl, you can tell me if I'm wrong, but there's a kind of pride that, you know, nothing comes first except this production and this play. Like if you get, you know, it's not that you can't go do something else and it will work around you, but there's kind of a feeling that, you know, this comes first, the theater comes first.
You can disagree. Do you mind if I think that was very true during a particular time. Right. I think that's changing.
Yeah, I agree. Right. Yeah, it's become more careerist.
Yes.
Let's just call it what it is. Chicago theater, unfortunately, like the rest of the world, the country has definitely taken a more careerist term.
And needing money. Right. I mean, actors need money, and we don't make that much money in theater. So right. I think that's also it.
Yeah, and Chicago had an advantage of the cost of living was certainly lower than LA and New York. But as that grew, it probably put more pressure on the performing community. Yeah, everyone's nodding. I'm sorry to bring up cost of living.
No, I'm taking that in to you.
Also, yeah, no, I want to ask, like, I mean, my assumption is that the theater going audience in Chicago is also more open to homegrown written independent theater. Whereas, you know, in LA, when you put on I'll have people from the film festival send me an email saying, hey, my play is this weekend. And I'm like, I'm going, because like, I promised myself I'd see five, step into five, you know, 30 seat theaters this year. And I've done like too, and it's December. it's as an audience member, it's tough. It's tough to get audiences in LA. It's really hard.
It's hard in Chicago too.
It's hard. I agree. Yeah.
It's hard everywhere. And in Chicago, because there are so many theaters competing, in some ways it's even harder for individual theaters to get audiences. Would you say, Cheryl?
I agree. I feel like, I think 20 years ago, it was quite different. I think that your critic could not like your show and you could still, word of mouth could really make a difference. It still can, but it's not like it used to be. I feel like we've become sort of what New York, everyone said New York was, which is like, if the critics don't like it, bye-bye, you know? So I think it's changing.
For sure. All right. Well, let's refocus back to you both. So you are both involved in theater in Chicago, and what are you doing and when do you meet?
Well, how did we meet? Basically, I had do you want to go, Cheryl? Or
No, Shelley, you're on it.
I'm on it. I don't feel on it, but thank you. I had a play that was being done at a theater in Chicago called Victory Gardens. And it was my first full length production. I'd had a lot of smaller monologues and short pieces done all over the place. But this is my first full length production at a kind of, I don't know what you'd call it.
Historic and big theater. Yeah.
Historic big theater. And so I was, scared. But fortunately, we cast Cheryl in the lead, the amazing Cheryl, and that's how we met. And Cheryl and I pretty much right away, just artistically, creatively had this bond from that time on. We just seemed to speak the same language. We seemed to think more psychologically about work, and we're very emotional people. And so we formed a strong bond pretty much immediately from that production on. Would you say, Cheryl?
Oh my gosh. Well, you can tell that you are a brilliant writer because that I have nothing else to add. That's it. Yeah, that's totally it. Yeah.
And there is certainly something special when the playwright, and were you directing the play as well?
No, I have never directed.
When you see the lead just take to your words, and as an actor, when you meet the person who wrote the words, obviously, yeah, how can you not bond if that chemistry is there?
Yeah.
So I have this problem with my work generally, that it's very, and this is about Cheryl, it's very character-based, and there's usually a long process that an actor has to go to land in the right place. Once they land there, they can do anything. Like there's no way to say a line. But they have to find the character before it will. And maybe this is true of all work. I don't know, but this is particularly true of my work.
I agree.
And more often than not, when an actor will think they understand the work, get into rehearsal, get completely lost, get upset, get angry, blame me, blame the script, blame God, blame the government that they're not, getting the script. And then if they're like Cheryl and they're persistent, smart, creatively open and psychologically aware, they will usually discover that the thing about the character that they were overlooking was the part of themselves that they didn't want to access or admit or something. And when they when they go through this psychological journey to find that part, everything opens up. They blossom and bloom and then just fly in the character. And Cheryl is such a wonderful actress and like me, so process oriented that she is able to take my work and go through that process and then you see the results. So that's a long way of saying too much.
I don't think it's too much at all. I will say that I feel Shelley, a story is sacred. Everyone's story is sacred. But Shelley has such you have such an insight into her deep, unexplored, complex parts of characters that if you miss an aspect of it, it's not fitting. And so I just love how I mean, I know people say just trust the text. Okay, so you can say trust the text, but I go, what the fuck is that? I mean, that's a fucking process in itself. So I the thing that was exciting was that Shelley, and I mean, I think Shelley saw, I'm not going to give up. I'm going to keep going, right, because it was, it's a process to get to the characters and the world that you're creating, and right, and a reward. I would say, I'm going to get spiritual here. A spiritually fulfilling process if you choose to go on that journey and to go there.
Right. Thank you.
I'm going to just tag team because, yeah. So, like, Shelley and I think that's what one of the things we really felt, that theater was not just about story. It was about a revolution of yourself, an expansion of the self. And that we believed that, and I still believe, that as an actor, who you get called to play is a ritual. And there is something divine about going there. And I feel Shelley creates this intense tribe within her stories. And you got to be on board. You got to be on board. Yeah.
Hopefully there's a big payoff.
There's an amazing payoff. There's a huge payoff, but we have to go there. And that's what you and I, and Shelley and I for years would work. We worked with another friend of ours of how do we get there? We worked on process of how to get there.
Yeah.
And the payoff is the reward of the work being exceptional, or what is the payoff?
That's a great question.
Or is it that inner satisfaction of...
I'll speak as... Shelley, do you want to take this or...
No, because you're the one who experienced it.
As an actor, I think that the payoff is an expansion of yourself, of something that was holding you in, and you expand more into your true self. I know we're at the,
this no, is that's
church.
Good.
It's a church. It's sacred. I'm just it's sacred talk, but I think story is sacred. I really do. That's what I want when I go to story and I see story. And I also feel for the audience members, and it's not just for the actor, that if I go through that, then the audience will also go through that. Like, I want to see stories that transform me, that ask me to transform, that alchemy, to take my shitty life and make it gold. That's what I want.
Yeah, no, I mean, I'll add to the spiritual thing, because I believe I'm in on it.
I
get anthropological or whatever the adjective is I'm searching for, is that the most human thing, our brains, whatever their design is, at the end of the day, we sat around a campfire in a cave and we told each other stories. And that is how our brains function. And that's how we communicate. This is my life to you. And this is how I learn about other people's lives. And it's obviously how we develop relationships and empathy. I mean, the essence of humanity is storytelling.
I agree.
Yeah. It forces you beyond yourself. Forces you to go beyond yourself to imagine and think of other lives and other places and other feelings. And
I see us going back 5,000 years and there's no technology and there's we're not even writing yet. So, so I look at writers like yourselves as people who would have been rhyming because we rhymed all our stories, right? Even the ancient texts all rhymed. They were all verse, right? So not prose, it was verse, because that was the only way we could remember it.
Mm-hmm. Right.
People don't realize that the Torah rhymes in Hebrew, because everyone just says these words on and on, but it rhymed because that's the only way humans remember stuff. And so, yeah, the people, the playwrights, and maybe even the screenwriters, those were the people who were sharing around that campfire. All right. Well, I'll drop the, but yeah, that's
I love it.
I think that's why we all connect to it so much.
Yeah.
Right.
And even if our fucking campfire is turned into Netflix, at least it's still a shared experience. Everyone's like, you got to watch the new thing on Netflix. And I'm like, oh, man.
Do I have to watch it? Really? Do I have to watch it?
But some things I like. Some things I certainly like.
I know.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I still think that even isolated in our own homes during COVID, we still, you know.
We really, really needed stories then. But
yes.
We really craved them then.
Yeah.
And this crazy Zoom thing, which somehow beat the shit out of Skype, but this crazy Zoom thing all of a sudden became our campfire again. And we started, right? Nice. We started just gathering on Zoom.
Yeah. Nice.
Yeah.
And that's what, if I can say something about theater, even though I appreciate that you went from theater to using a camera. But yeah, the immediacy of theater just cannot be equaled.
Mm-hmm.
To be in the room with the people.
Yeah, it really can't, which is, you know, why so many actors want to go back and forth, whether they can or not, they want to. And it's a very different medium. That's the other thing. It's different. You know, it's similar, but it's different. And, you know, we've seen actors who maybe are good in one, don't necessarily know how to translate to the other and vice versa. But yeah, it's amazing. Theater is amazing. So is film.
So is film.
They are amazing. And both can provide transcendent experiences, you know, different ways, but.
Absolutely. Well, so with film, as actors, and you're both actors in Chicago and both.
I stopped acting completely.
You were solely writing.
I stopped acting in college after high school. That was it. I did my time.
And no one could grab you by the wrist and pull you up.
In fact, the opposite. I literally it terrifies me right now. Like the thought. I mean, even doing this podcast, I'm like, oh my God, I have to talk in front of other people. Seriously. But no, I'm terrified of the whole thing and have nothing but, you know, just deep, deep, deep admiration for actors and what they are able to do. So no.
Okay. So Cheryl gets the next question more so, I guess, which is, so we talked about the difference between stage acting and camera acting or film acting, although film and TV, but was that in Chicago, did that become a balance? Like, were you doing stage and then of course with an agent and stuff seeking, you know, TV and commercials and the films that came into town?
Yeah. How do I answer this? I teach cinema classes and I teach classes for directors, of how to talk to actors and what the actor's process is. And I teach animators. So I think because I live in the world of theater as well as on camera, I have checklists of what to remember when you're going to this world. And that doesn't mean that I always remember it carefully. Like in commercial world is different than film and television, or, you know, how do I do this? So I think being an educator also has really helped me traverse both mediums. And a few years ago, and I was with a theater company in town, two different theater companies, and that was fabulous. And then maybe I'll go back to theater. I dream about theater, but right now my focus is really, how do we create more in front of the camera? That's for me. Yeah.
Well, I got a question for each of you. So I'm creating chaos by asking it both at the same time, but I guess I want to know, Because Shelley, you also moved into directing as well, right? Or should I not? Because I'm assuming that based upon, you know, The Resentful Angel is the rare film that went for it and listed four directors.
Yes, we did.
Which is perfectly.
I mean, why not? And
probably more honest than most films, most indie films. There's one person and they're like, they probably could say they were co-directors and sometimes they don't. But
right.
Feel free to say however you transitioned to directing, or you can just say, no, I didn't, just for that one. And I'm curious when Cheryl became an educator. So,
people would always ask me why I didn't direct my plays. Because I was always so like, oh, they're so complicated. It has to be a very special process to make them work. And people are like, why don't you just direct them? And I never felt like I could direct them. I didn't feel like I knew enough about directing. And also, I think I didn't have the confidence, I think, to go through the process as a director. With The Resentful Angel, because we were executive producers, and executive producers in television are, it's more directors. It's got very complicated because Cheryl and I directed in terms of many aspects of this TV pilot. But on set, we brought people so that we could do the things that we needed to do. I am not a director. Cheryl is much more of a director than I am for film. I continue as a writer. I like to have a creative say in production. So maybe I like to be a half director. Maybe that's why we had four directors. Mm. If I could just be half director, that would suit me just fine. Because, but Cheryl, I think, is more serious about becoming a director or directing, not becoming, because she's already done it in film than I am. I'm writing. So
if I may throw out a praise to you, Shelley, you have always known how to talk to actors.
Thank
you. So, I mean, so you were an acting coach of mine and continue to be, you know what I'm saying? Like, who do I invite to a show to say, how am I doing? Shelley Daniels. Shelley, I feel like if you don't mind me saying Shelley, and just let me know, give me a signal of, cut it off. But I would say you are a director. She's an extraordinary director. And I just want to say, to be in post-production with Shelley Daniels was just, I've never quite seen anyone do what she did. The musicality and how sensitive your musical ear is.
Thank you.
In editing as well as the sound design, I just was like, I don't know what you're saying. I don't know what you're doing. And then you do, and I'd be like, it works. It's brilliant. It's great. It's it. So
that's funny. That's what the editors would say to me too. Like, I don't know what she's doing.
Right.
Just please do it.
Yeah. So I would say that there were just so many things happening, and we were on such a time crunch to get into production that we wanted to do it just us. And then there was someone else who was on board who we thought would be perfect, that would tag team with us, and they fell through. And so this is not to say that our two directors weren't fabulous. They brought so much to our press. Say that again.
On set.
On set. They brought so much on set. Yeah, it was really basically an eight-day chunk of time. That's where they were, and they showed up. And
just to clarify for people listening, Cheryl and I had this idea, which... we'd have one director deal with the actors and one director deal with the technical aspects. And it was controversial at the time, but we were determined to experiment in this way. We experiment with our first TV pilot, like, let's experiment with the form, even though we've never done it before. But that's what we did. We thought, in my experience on sets and Cheryl's experience on sets, we noticed that a director often had a stronger suit. Like, they were either better at the technical stuff and not so good with actors, or great with actors, but not so good. So we thought, let's just split it up into two roles. So that's what we did.
No, I'm sure there's a lot of heads nodding over time to that statement, because yes, there are the idea that one person is the perfect fit for all the right, because the director, not a lot of people know, unless they've made a film, that the director answers 1,000 technical questions a day.
Yes.
And then it's supposed to turn to the actors and help them deliver a beautiful performance.
Exactly.
And that's a big fucking ask. But yeah. I have failed as a podcaster and interviewer because we're already deep into the Resentful Angel and we didn't cover it all, how it came into being. If and when Cheryl first, because Cheryl, you're credited as writer, so I assume this was
I didn't write this at all. This was all Shelley.
Oh, Shelley's credited as writer. That's right.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's okay. Right. There's so many. There's
right,
so many
right.
credits.
And there are so big names in front of me. But right. So Shelley, you wrote it, and then as a pilot with that in mind, and then
it came out of, you know, first of all, I wrote this for Cheryl. I should just I wrote this for Cheryl and I to create. I sort of think of how a lot of people write when they write for actors, you know, or when people cast, they cast against type. I try to write against type. So, you know, as you can tell, Cheryl is this very open, positive, you know, wonderful person. And so against type is sort of negative, closed off, the character that you saw. And it came out of a conversation that Cheryl and I were having about feeling frustrated in our careers, you know, just the typical whatever conversation that we all have, you know, about feeling like just not satisfied about where we were. And so I wanted to write something that was about that aspect, about having a dream and not necessarily reaching it, or where does that leave you?
Yeah.
And also because Cheryl and I, obviously what we have in common is this backdrop of Chicago theater, which I always, and I think Cheryl agrees, the special rawness and coolness of Chicago theater that has never really been captured.
Explored.
Maybe in The Bear, weirdly enough. Like,
yeah, yes.
What Chicago, that environment, like just the kind of tough, raw tumble. And again, it may be a thing of the past to some extent, although it still exists somewhat, but kind of the gritty, dirty, grimy aspect of it. And the beautiful ensemble, passionate, committed aspect of it too, you know? So I kind of wanted to do both, you know, write Cheryl this character, you know, based on this idea of frustration in the context of Chicago theater. So,
yeah.
And clearly the lead character is a bit of an archetype as well. I mean, you are having a lot of fun with that character's ego.
Yeah. Well, I'm sorry. I just want to say,
Shelley, go, Shelley. No, Shelley.
Earlier, you nailed it, Jeff, which is that I've always, you know, growing up sort of before whatever current wave of feminism is, you know, there was a strong feeling in me about the injustice of the lack of broadness of women, of female characters. And so anytime I have an opportunity to take a female character into a place that's quirky or dark or weird or something that, you know, and it's so common now to do that. So it's not like I was the first or I'm doing anything that great. But I did have that impulse with this character, and then, you know, Cheryl took it and ran with it.
And I'm sure there was no shortage of actors you've met over time who make a big fucking deal out of their having one line on a TV show.
Exactly. Yes, both in LA and in Chicago.
And then at the end, actually admits that she didn't get it right.
Right. It was a dream.
It was a dream.
She thought she got it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Walks around and telling everyone, look, I was on, I forget which Chicago show was.
Chicago Fire.
Chicago Fire.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter.
Chicago Fire. Yeah.
It really doesn't matter.
But there is a different quality for each.
So creative, aren't they? Boy, they're always challenging themselves to do something new.
Cheryl, have you been on Chicago?
I've been on Chicago PD and Chicago Fire, so we can't. I do not agree with these views of these two people. They have given me rent and mortgage payments.
I'm just saying that whoever comes up with the titles maybe could put in an extra minute or two.
Maybe.
But that's probably the network anyway. They could have had wonderful working titles, and then the network said, Well, if we call it Chicago Fire, people will know.
Right. We could go on from there, you know, like Chicago, I don't know, Chicago cemeteries. I don't know.
Please, let's do it. I'm there.
But and you said it was an 8-day shoot, which I guess we can dive into that. And you did the creative, by the way, so you're creative, hiring two directors and hiring one to focus on performance and one to focus on technical. Is that something you do again? Are you happy with it?
I think this is, Shelley and I have not had this conversation, so we're going to have it live. I feel that I would. What was tricky was because of things, as we all know, of, you know, filmmakers and cinematic makers, that we, time is very, you know, when we were the two people who were really in charge of gathering everything, there was something that we had two people who were going through extreme moments of their life. One who was just on a major, she was out of town doing Angels in America at Berkeley Rep and just had come back. And then one who was moving. And I think the move was unexpected. And so to get them together before the first day of the shoot did not happen.
Well, it
tried.
Did. Yeah.
Yeah. No, please. What were
no,
you
no, you're right. I was thinking it did on the phone or a little bit, but not. Yeah.
We
not
tried, either. But it just right. didn't happen. And then so the first few days were challenging. I'll just say, not just challenging of who does this, who does this, how do we do this? And, that's where I'll stop.
Yeah, no, it's just, I agree. I would, what we didn't know what to expect. We didn't know, you know, and I would do it again as well. However, what we learned was just huge, you know, and that is exactly what Cheryl's saying. The amount, first of all, I would pick two people who knew each other and had a language together, probably, that could work with them. These people had never worked together, had no way to, the different communication styles, different everything.
Yeah.
So I would just be a lot more thoughtful about doing it. And as Cheryl is wisely saying, allow a lot of time for the, you know, collaboration to build before going on set. That's all. But as a concept, not a bad idea. Like it worked in some ways, it worked very well. So, you know,
I love it.
Yeah.
I mean, it reminds me of almost selecting a director and DP who have worked together right. many times, and the kind of director who turns to their DP and says, you handle all that technical shit. I'm not going to talk about lenses or anything.
Right.
You make sure it looks great. You make sure that the lighting's right. You control those department heads, and I'm going to, you know, not over manage you because I'm going to be working with these actors.
Right. Right. That sounds great. Yeah. We maybe could have done that too.
Like if we had but you have right. to find a director
right.
who has a DP they love and trust. And then right. you also have to hope that those two look, there's a million factors going on in every.
That's it. You know,
there really
know.
Are. Yeah. You have to factors. Hope that they still like each other. Like, they did all this great stuff together and you got it when they're fighting. You know,
like. When I went to this dark place where I thought your way was better because you brought two strangers together who couldn't unite against you. If you bring in a set team, maybe they're like, okay, we know better. We're going to, you know what I mean? But I'm wrong.
Yes.
There's good and bad and there's kind and thoughtful and yes. there's thoughtless. Yeah, there's yes. no, just because a team works together doesn't mean they're like, well, we know what we're doing.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Right. It's like you say, there's just a million variables, right? There's so many variables.
And I want to add praise to the fact that you tried something because mm-hmm. why not try different things when you're making something independently?
Right. Thank you. Sorry.
Because Lord knows the standard way of doing things doesn't always work well. Although I do have a fun tip for you, and this is just based upon the Sherman Oaks Film Festival that we held last month. Look into identical twins. We had three films co-directed by twins who were identical twins. What were the odds of that? By the third Q&A, when the twins came upstage, I was like, okay, there's a theme. But anyway.
Are you kidding me? And you didn't know when you selected the films, you had no idea.
No, I only knew about, I knew that one set of brothers were identical twins from previous, because they had been at the festival like 4 or 5 years earlier. But the other two sets of brothers, I just assumed, you know, lots of siblings work together, right? Because they grow up shooting stuff with video cameras and stuff. But then they walk out and they're like, yeah, twins, you can't tell us apart. So it's crazy. Wow.
Oh my gosh.
Oh my God. And maybe there are more identical twins in generations coming up because of all the birth stuff that became more popular.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
So that, whereas, you know, for me, identical twins, I mean, that was such a rarity, but I don't know. I'm just wondering if maybe it's a little more common. I'm not that having three with selected films is not really kind of shocking.
It's kind of weird. Yeah. three out of whatever, 70 films. That's a pretty high percentage. But anyway, I threw that in to be silly. I'm sorry. So
I love it.
We like it.
I love it.
We like silly.
Yeah. I always wonder why people don't cast twins more often so that you can, you know. But
brilliant.
Anyway.
It's brilliant. write that down, Cheryl. Next it's one.
I wrote it down. Twins. I wrote it down when it was said.
Well, think about how many special effects you can just cheat and, like, you know, have the person
change. Oh, saves time in post. Love it.
All that time in post. So you made this film, by the way. I'll jump backwards and stop distracting you both from your project. So it was all pre-COVID, yes?
Yeah.
Yes, very much pre-COVID. How do you say it, Cheryl?
Right when we had Picture Lock, it was Picture 2 weeks lock. before lockdown.
Before lockdown. Picture Lock, before. Lockdown.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. So then all you had left was like sound and some other things to do in post.
I'm sorry. Not Picture Lock. Everything was locked.
Oh, the whole thing
Whole thing was finished. The whole thing was finished 2 weeks before. So, which was like a few, but like a, and then a scratch head, like, what do I do?
And were festivals on your mind and like you submitted to festivals and then found, and then the virtual thing happened?
Yeah, we did. We knew the festivals we wanted to submit to, and thank goodness I've heard other people on your show talk about how expensive it is, and it is expensive, but we went for grants. I mean, grants really saved us. I learned how to write grants. Shelley was a fabulous, you know, proofreader and saying, gosh, Cheryl, don't look at
Cheryl,
this. Look
you
at this.
Did it all. Cheryl, you did. Cheryl is really, I mean, really not that you, this, you want to be this, this to be your talent, but you are an extremely talented grant writer.
But I will not do it for anyone else. So I'm just going to say that. No one, please don't hire me. I don't want to do it. it's a labor of love for myself, or it's something I believe in.
So what you did before production, or you did it after for finishing funds and festival
we did
run?
It throughout the whole time, the whole way. We just kept looking for grants. Here's what, we could do this. This will get us through production. This will get us through post-production. We have an unusually large cast, and most of them were SAG, and myself included. And so, SAG-AFTRA, I should say. And so we knew we were going to do the festival scene. We were like, I don't think we should wait. I think this is the time. We need to just trust that this is the time. This is what's happened. So let's just go for it. And then I remember when we were in your festival, I'll just little thing. I had moved to St. Lucia for 6 months because I could work remotely. So I was in St. Lucia and having these peepers, these little frogs, at night, so I had to be on mute the whole time with flying cockroaches. And so it was we did a lot during the pandemic. We were working during the pandemic, which was actually exciting.
We also wrote, I spent a lot of the pandemic writing the series Bible, which I had never written a series Bible before and didn't quite know just how demanding and involved a process that would be. But I did spend a good portion of the pandemic doing that. So we now have, for what it's worth, we have a series Bible.
Well, I'm just going to tell you what I think it's worth. Shelley, because I love being read to, Shelley read me the series Bible and I was like, oh, no, are you kidding? Oh my God. I mean, we are determined to get this series made because the twists and turns are so unexpected and it is an actor's and director's dream where you take it. It's just mind blowing.
Be really fun. It would be really fun.
I love that. Fun is great.
Thank you, Cheryl.
I confess that my mind is still, dealing with the jealousy that you ran to the Caribbean during COVID lockdown.
I know.
I mean, well, Shelley and I had to talk about that because, you know, we are partners. So I had to say, are you okay with me doing this? And we talked, we made agreements about this is what has to happen. So,
I mean, as long as you have broadband, right? And I recall during COVID that I would look at like, remember, we were all obsessed with COVID statistics for the first 3 to 6 months of that experience. And I remember seeing U.S. Virgin Islands, like zero cases. And I was like,
it was zero cases. But I'll just say there were other, life on an island, there are challenges. There are challenges. Yeah. A volcano brought us back. I'll just say that.
Which sounds a little scary.
I'm an actor, so I have a wonderful imagination. It may not have been as bad as it sounded, but it was next door. And I'm glad to be back in Chicago. Really glad to be back and back near Shelley.
Wonderful. Wonderful. And well, I guess I didn't ask the question of, I mean, was this, I know about the first play, but were there many plays? Has this collaboration been going for a while and it been very fruitful?
I would say we, in between the show that Cheryl did of mine and then The Resentful Angel, I would say that we spent time as creative collaborators in the sense of we were always talking about process. We were always talking about, we actually met, as Cheryl said, we have a friend who was actually in The Resentful Angel, who plays Clark. The three of us would meet and just meet regularly and talk about the process of creating theater and then bring whatever theater experiences we were having. Kind of, it was like half theater group therapy and half sort of theoretical spiritual exploration about a life in theater. And so we were always doing that. The interestingly, for whatever reason, my productions tended to be outside of Chicago at a certain point. And Cheryl was always performing in Chicago. And that was probably, and it's a great question because that's probably part of the reason why we also wanted to do The Resentful Angel was so that we could work together again. So, yeah.
And it makes perfect sense. Yeah, because look, I often say to people at this festival level, especially when you see chemistry and actually especially performance duos, I would say, please make a bunch of things together because I grew up in the era where there were actual comedy teams and actual or even dramatic teams. But, you know, whether it was Matthau and Len, you know, I mean, it's like that. You don't see it anymore.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's so nice.
You know,
that's
and isn't it nice when people collaborate over and over and things just keep getting better and better?
Right. Really? Yeah. Right.
You're right. It is special. Like it should be, you know, that it's, you're good. You're right to recognize that there, you know, chemistry doesn't just happen everywhere.
That's it.
Yeah. Yeah. That's even it. with the people who met in Toronto and Chicago and ended up on SNL, the ones who stayed together, I think it's richer results.
Definitely. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, there's something unspoken that gets transmitted back and forth that is really exciting, actually.
Yeah. And I'll add that, you know, when Tina Fey writes for Rachel Dratch, it's just special.
Totally. I'm with you. I'm with you on that.
But they don't get to do it that much.
Right.
Well, is there, what did we miss? Is there something important we missed?
I'm gonna think.
I mean, have you been able, besides the Bible, has there been anything Resentful Angelish since, or not so much, just kind of waiting to see what happens?
I mean, we did a ton of festivals over the pandemic, so just tons, you know, and I was just thinking about it the other day, because of all of them, I would have loved to have gone to SOF for sure. Like, you just put together such a wonderful festival and just, you know, for so many reasons, but we actually never went, what was it? 20, we got into like 25, 30 something, mm-hmm. won awards, all of that. It's a strange thing. We didn't go to one of them,
right,
you know,
right.
We didn't go to one of them.
Right.
So it's slightly, I don't want to say alienating. It's not exactly the right word, but it's a different feeling about
right.
it than had we experienced them in person, IRL.
Like, anticlimactic in a way, because you know, what's funny is, I don't know if you remember, but for the 2020 Sherman Oaks Film Festival, I mean, it was November 2020, we were all realizing this thing isn't going to go away,
right?
And we were about to have a massive holiday surge, but in November 2020 we couldn't be in the theater, but we held an outdoor in-person mixer.
I remember
wearing masks.
Oh, that's right. That's right.
And someone came from Portland and someone came from Austin. Like they traveled, they hopped in a car and traveled many states because they're like, I haven't been around other filmmakers.
Right.
And of course, at the time they were saying it had been about 8 months. And I just was like, I was like, okay, I'm going to hug you because you came from Texas.
Yeah. Oh. Yeah. I would have wanted to have done that for sure. I mean, I did want to do that. I think back then, you know, I was scared about flying, I think. And I don't think we could have driven from Chicago, but if it had been any closer, I think we would have been those.
Yeah. That's a particularly tough drive, right? Because the Texas to LA thing, it's flat.
Right.
Chicago to LA.
It's a bit more.
The Rocky Mountains are in the way.
Yeah, exactly.
That's not a fun drive.
Those little mountains. Those little hills.
It's not a fun drive to go over the Rockies.
No, beautiful, right. though. But
yeah. Beautiful to look at.
Yeah.
Or riding a bicycle over it.
Oh, you did that.
No.
But I thought you did that.
We had a documentary of a guy who did it on a bicycle.
Oh, I love that.
Close enough. No. You may as well have written, just seen a documentary. So that's close enough.
A wonderful person who's clearly insane that he did this. But anyway.
Wow.
Well, thank you for saying you would. Of course, and Sherman Oaks Film Festival happens to be sort of in your childhood backyard or your middle school.
Very much. Not even sort of. Very much.
Is that what inspired you to submit, or was it our top 100 ranking or something?
I didn't know about your top 100 ranking when I first, although I'm so, you know, I'm not surprised you're in the top 100 because it, for us, definitely, I mean, top tier all the way as far as our experience with festivals. Even though it wasn't even in person, you put so much into it. But
yeah.
I think the Sherman, I have to say, for me, it was just the personal Sherman Oaks connection, you know, just that it was home, you know, so.
And here we are with you.
Here we are.
I mean, and that you, and that there was no other film festival that had, that Shelley, was there any other film festival during that time that had a Zoom together and talked to each other, which I thought was really remarkable. I mean, not that I, maybe there was
one did a sort of a partial thing, but nothing to the extent that you did, Jeff, really nothing. And nothing that made us feel like that just made us feel as involved in a festival during COVID as yours did. Like, it really did make me feel part of the festival community and, you know, in a way that nothing else did. So thank you for that.
Right. Cause we had the Zoom mixers too. And,
right.
And the Zoom Q&A. Yeah. I don't know. I just felt like it would be a ripoff to, I know there are festivals that accepted people's submissions and charge the regular fee, and didn't hold screenings and didn't do a virtual screening and just handed out awards. And they must have had a real profitable year.
I
just thought you should either return the submission fees or do your best to replicate the festival online or virtually.
Yeah.
I don't know. And also,
I appreciate that you are about the coming together and the community of it all, which I think is everything. I really think it's everything.
I appreciate your conscientiousness.
Well, thank you so much. And obviously, look, I don't know why people get into this racket. There's no money in it, but I can say that obviously the thing I enjoy is filmmakers is discussing movies, is discussing this wonderful medium that I see it as you know, the caveman campfire.
I love
cave
it.
Person campfire. But yeah, if you're not going to have Q&As and mixers and have people interact about film, then people should just stay home and watch a streaming channel. Cause what's a film festival without the actual interaction and discussion? Well, anyway, enough about Sherm Oaks Film Festival. Do you want to, I believe there's a new website for Resentful Angel and whatnot. Do you want to share that stuff?
Yes, for sure. And if you're someone out there who is like, hey, I think I could help you get this series done, please check us out. So, it's theresentfulangel.com. Very simple. Theresentfulangel.com.
Yeah, absolutely. And social media too, or is that,
We do have a Facebook page. I just, I'll be honest with you. I'm not about social media right now. Maybe I shouldn't be, but I'm over the shoulds also. I'm trying to move away from shoulds in my life.
Cheryl was originally in charge of all our social media. She was amazing at it. Instagram, Facebook, I mean, she did it all. And she was she just made it so much fun. But I can see why, whether you're burnt out on it or just anti-social media at the moment. I mean, I get it. So yeah, we've definitely quieted our social media presence.
I love how you said that, Shelley. Yes.
Thank you.
Yes, it's gone quiet. I will share, and I shouldn't say this out loud, especially when it's being recorded, but I think that social media just rewards the people involved. In other words, I don't think that social media has ever brought a single person into the theater or online to view stuff. But it makes people feel good when the film festival on its social media platform on Instagram says, here's a poster of a film we're showing. And then their friends say, I'm so happy for you, blah, blah, blah. But we've actually, I won't name names, but we had a filmmaker, super wonderful film, actually, that you would both love. I'll tell you more when we're not recording. Okay. But said filmmaker had like 75,000 followers on TikTok.
Whoa.
And promoted the hell out of their screening and didn't sell a ticket.
Are you kidding?
So these people, so social media just doesn't relate to the real world.
Just doesn't translate.
I wish if I had a time machine, I would tell them, hey, emailing everyone you know will work better.
Right.
If you want people to be there to support your film. Because I think it was even the LA premiere, which is, wait till I tell you. But anyway.
Whoa.
Wow.
I shouldn't be sharing. But I'm not sharing that. And that filmmaker, I think, is wonderful. We've had that lesson a few times that social media does not.
And that's what we both felt. I mean, I kept it very much alive for, I think, 3 years. And then I was like, I think it was the beginning of this year. I was like, it's time to just sort of.
And I mean, you know, it's so easy to say and easy, you know, but, you know, I mean, social media, it's gross. It's gross. I'm sorry.
In some way, I mean, if
I just have to say it. I know it's got
in some ways.
I hate it. I'm not a fan. So, sorry.
Well,
the truth's coming out.
Don't. I love Shelley. I love you.
The truth's coming out.
My feed is almost 100% guinea pigs because We have a guinea pig. So I just follow a couple accounts like cute guinea pigs on Instagram. So
now that's
to say, with the exception of cute animals.
Yes, cute animals. And, you know, and then when my friends share pictures of their kids, I pretend I click like, you know, I give it a heart.
All right.
I'm okay. Like, if you What's think your kid you? Is as cute as a guinea pig, you're so wrong. But yeah, I agree. Social media is, we haven't figured out how to make it a good thing.
Right.
It should be a super effective tool for communication. But I think algorithmic amplification makes it the opposite, that there are algorithms that focus on time spent online, which means it's angertainment.
Right. And really it's advertising one form or another. It's all and so then people become their own brands and people are advertising themselves, and it's, mm-hmm. It's probably just too easy to say that it's dehumanizing in some way, but I'm not a fan. That's all. I'll shut up.
For sure. It's complicated. Yeah.
Yeah. It's very,
and yet we walk around, I'm applause to Cheryl for walking away from it, because I feel like I can't, because everyone's like, well, you got to be on it. And I'm like, do I? I guess
but
I do.
Why? For what? I'm not.
Not personally, but I mean, like for the festival, right. has to have an account. And right, I try as I might, there's never a staff member who will be as devoted. That myth that, someone will take it over for you.
I mean, that's true. Like, obviously in your position, and obviously we did do social media when we were promoting early on. So there is, but again, that falls under the advertising sort of segment. It's a marketing advertising tool, and a reality, but I wish there were a different tool and a different reality. That's all I'm going to say.
Absolutely. And I guess with that said, I'll wrap us up by naming a bunch of social media handles.
Okay, great.
All right, well.
Great, good. Yeah, let's do it.
Everybody listening should follow Discover Indie Film on Instagram and Twitter and Facebook. Although it's funny, now I won't go there, but obviously there's some reasons to quit Twitter now, but haven't done it yet. But if you want to learn about this podcast or the TV series that was born from it, you can go to discoverindiefilm.com. And on social media, it's always at DIFWINS. And we mentioned the Amazon Prime series. If you go to Prime Video, big TV, load up your Prime Video app and just go to search and type in Discover Indie Film. And in season 7, you will see The Resentful Angel, as well as, I think it's 24. I think it's a total of 25 films. So, boy, that would suck to be wrong. But it's 10 episodes, and it varies from, it's just, honestly, I'm kind of proud of this thing, because there's, we start with comedy, and then there's drama, and there's art house cinema. There's a film that was shot in multiple locations in Mexico and the UK, where people are performing dance. It's actually artistic dance films.
Fabulous.
And all kinds, just everything you could wonder about. It's everything. It's like, yes, you want to stay home and not go to film festivals, fine. If you watch Discover Indie Film, it's like you've been to a festival.
I am so excited to see this season. I cannot wait. I mean, I've been watching them. I'm into season 2 now, and I just love them. It is like the lazy person's film festival. You don't have to actually go to the film festival. The film festival can come to you. It's pretty amazing. It's amazing.
Thank you. Well, see, so there you go. And with Shelley having said that, be kind. Like and subscribe to the podcast you're listening to if you want to be nice and write a good review. And on that TV series, you do have to buy it. Amazon won't let people review it without buying it. But you know what? Be nice and write a 5-star review, because Lord knows, I don't think there are bad reviews of it, but most people watch it, enjoy it, and don't write a review. In fact, I laugh because there are fewer reviews than there are filmmakers involved of every season.
Isn't, I'm hearing some things there. I'm hearing some things. I'm hearing an invitation.
Not at all directed at you two. Your season, your season ain't even up.
I know,
but I wrote a review for season one. I'll just say I did write a review for season one. Well, I'm just saying that
makes you nicer than about 20 of the people whose work is on. Well, no, I bet season one has probably 15 to 20 5-star reviews, but you'd think having 20 plus films.
Well, I'm going to, here's now, Jeff, I have a theory about this because actors are like this. Cause sometimes you do a show, you do, and I'm talking about film, something in film or a TV show, and then you never watch it because you're on to the next. It's what's next. And I do think that's the challenge, and I feel the problem of this culture, that we can't sit still and like appreciate what we just got because we're always looking for the next. So this is a call for a review for me.
That could be it. All right, yeah. Well, I've made my plea for a review. And of course, I think also Amazon makes it a little tricky because here I am encouraging people to watch it on a big TV, not their computer. But I think most of the smart TV apps, you can't write your review on there. You have to go to the Amazon website after you've watched it and find Discover Indie Film. And that's a barrier, right?
And you have to watch the entire, like, when you told me about the reviews, I was going to write one. It's like, it doesn't allow you to write a review until you've watched the entire series, which is fine. You know, that, I guess, as it should be, except, you know, I would have written one halfway through if it had let me. So I would have, because I was loving it.
Yeah, I know. It's funny. In order for me to write a review, I have to let it autoplay in the background. I just play the whole season in the background without watching it because I've seen everything multiple times. And then I get to write a review in my wife's name because my Prime account happens to be in her name.
What was the little animal you have? A little gopher? What do you have?
Oh, that's a wombat.
A wombat. No, you were saying on your social media, you have a wombat. Is that right?
Oh, no. That's Chester the guinea pig.
The guinea pig. I don't see why Chester can't start writing reviews. Just
Well, he could, but he's not going to buy a Prime account, so
okay.
He doesn't. Although, believe me, most of his hay and food pellets come from. I wish it wasn't Amazon, but hardly a couple of locals. Now, watch. I'll show you two a picture of him. But anyway, I'm so derailed. All right, so I mentioned the Discover Indie Film.
That's our
fault. We also talked about the Sherman Oaks Film Festival. If you want to learn about that festival that we hold every November, just go to ShermanOaksFF.com, and it's at ShermanOaksFF on social media. And there is a sister festival called Film Invasion Los Angeles, and you can learn about that one if you go to FilmInvasionLA.com, and it's at FilmInvasionLA on social media. And whatever, we've had a very clean discussion, but I'll just mention my other thing. What the hell? As of now, there's a little puppy called High TV, HITV. And if you go to watchhightv.com or on any smart TV or like Roku, Amazon Fire TV or Apple TV, there's an app called High TV that is all programming that's wonderful to watch if you live in a place where marijuana is legal.
Oh. So not high as in, hi, how are you? But H-I-G-A.
High as in, well, first of all, the films are all amazing and wonderful and well done. And if you are someone who can use marijuana responsibly in a way that does not negatively affect your life, this is a really nice way to unwind because... What can I say? I found that when I'm going around a streaming service with a remote, if I happen to be legally enjoying THC in my system, I have a hard time finding something I want to watch. So it's just kind of led to this.
Oh, I love that.
So that you created, you found like this is a niche. Like
it's the niche. There's a longer version, which is we held a THC cinema at the theater twice, and it was a fun night.
Sounds
and
fun.
Of course, we had to urge people to Uber over to the theater. but it was tough. And I was like, you know, the truth, I kind of put it together. Like, nah, people want to get stoned and stay home. Mm-hmm. Asking people to drag their ass out to the theater to watch, you know, 15, 20 short films in a row. in a but by the way, that it was very rewarding. Even though I lost money on this little venture, I was at THC Cinema movie night. Like, I was sitting in that theater, and when the light, right before the lights came up at the end of the shorts program, that was like, you know, 90 minutes of shorts, there's a voice like four rows behind me, and this woman just said, "This has to happen again."
That needs to be a review.
That's the best response, great review. Right? That's the best response. Wow. So it was a success, and everyone had a high old time.
It was a wonderful time. And a company that does smart TV apps would always hassle me to do a smart TV app for Discover Indie Film. And my response was always, yeah, I don't. I wish I was independently wealthy, but I don't really think that Discover Indie Film was a niche that could support a whole streaming service.
Right. Oh, wow.
But the high TV niche kind of felt like it could, because it's global. And I think there's people all over the world who are now enjoying what I think. It's funny because we're all around the same age, I think. So
yeah,
for me, there's still a taboo around it. Like, I feel like I have to say,
right,
I'm not a big stoner. Like, I don't.
Right.
But, you know, at the end of a stressful day, if you're in a bad mood,
why not?
I'm stoned
all the time.
I'll have an edible, and all of a sudden, all those things that bothered me don't bother me anymore.
That sounds wonderful.
I had a nice tool to discover during COVID.
Yeah. Great tool.
So,
Oh my God.
it led to. Last time this company hit me up to do a Discover Indie Film smart TV app, I was like, no. And then the next day I'm like, oh,
but I
maybe
could do
this other idea could work. So anyway, I'm now mentioning it at the end of the podcast.
And it does work. That's the amazing thing. I mean, Jeff, that's pretty amazing. Like, you just followed your, you know, intuition and your whatever and what you like to do, and just figured out that this would be a good thing, and it is. It sounds
we'll
like it's
and knock on wood, the people will come. We'll see.
Yeah, they will. They'll come stoned, but they'll come.
I don't think I can get grants for it to market it, but we'll see.
Yet, maybe yet.
Yeah.
Yet.
Maybe no, just get stoned and do it.
You know, you'd think that the huge companies that are providing stuff to the dispensary, I'm saying the manufacturers of the gummies I eat, they should totally be sponsoring. But
oh my God.
Ooh, a shout out.
Huge. Oh my God. You could really follow that up. Wow.
I tried, but I'm not good at that. I'm a terrible salesperson. So. Oh.
Well, I just
love movies.
And one of them hear about it. I mean, it would be a good avenue for them, it sounds like. So
I agree.
I got to admit, everyone I bring this up to is like, that's a cool idea.
Mm-hmm.
And I swear to you, you don't have to be high to enjoy these films. It just helps. All right. Well, with that said, I've probably devoted too much time to these things. So we'll wrap this up. Thank you so much, Cheryl Grafe and Shelley Daniels.
Thank you, Jeff. For those
listening, if you listen to the next podcast, you'll get to listen to these two creative people talk about their favorite films and whatnot in the next podcast. So be sure to wait for that one, or it should come a couple days after this one. And thank you both so much.
Thank you, Jeff.
Thank you, Jeff. A joy.
And thank you, everyone, for listening.